journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, April 6th, 2011, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
A Pacifica Radio day-long special on the state of American labor. We'll discuss the legacy of MLK's labor organizing on today's struggles, an eyewitness report from Wisconsin, and how immigrant labor fits into today's labor organizing.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Hello and welcome to Uprising. On April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. The venerated civil rights leader is best remembered for his fearless commitment to nonviolence in the struggle for racial equality. However, his pursuit of racial justice was linked to the pursuit of a more just society in many arenas, including that of workers' rights. King was killed while traveling in Memphis in support of a historic strike of the city's black sanitation workers. The men were paid less than their white counterparts, endured dangerous working conditions, and were being denied the right to join a union. 43 years later, gains made by labor are being rolled back by city and state governments nationwide. Elected officials are saying the deep recession justifies the decimation of collective bargaining rights. Additionally, public employees are being asked to tighten their belts through a wide range of measures, including unpaid furlough days, pay freezes, and cuts in health benefits. As in King's time, workers of color remain particularly disadvantaged by labor troubles. Nationally, in February, 8% of whites were unemployed, compared to 15.3% of blacks. Addressing these striking sanitation workers, King spoke of the dignity of labor in a speech that he gave on March 18th, just days before he was assassinated.
You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor. So often we overlook the worth and the significance of those who are not in professional jobs, of those who are not in the so-called big jobs. But let me say to you tonight that whenever you are engaged in work that serves humanity and is for the building of humanity, it has dignity and it has worth. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
And that was an excerpt of a March 18, 1968 speech by Martin Luther King Jr., just a few weeks before he was assassinated. It was a speech focused on labor. My guest is Michael Honey. He is the Fred T. and Dorothy G. Haley Endowed Professor of the Humanities and Professor of Labor and Ethnic Studies and American History at the University of Washington in Tacoma. He's also an award-winning author. His books include Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, and Martin Luther King's Last Campaign. His latest book is called All Labor Has Dignity. Michael Honey spoke at the We Are One rally held by the AFL-CIO in D.C. on April 4th. Welcome to Uprising.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So much of what Martin Luther King Jr. said in his speeches, particularly near the end of his life, was focusing on labor and the economic rights of Americans. And this is something I think that a lot of people forget about. How relevant is what he had to say today?
Well, it's especially relevant this week when there are labor protests going on all over the country for the whole week, focusing on April 4th when Dr. King died. But basically, people are rallying around the thing that Dr. King died for, which was the right to organize a union, the right to collective bargaining, and included with that is a collection of dues and trying to maintain a strong union. These are exactly the things that Governor of Wisconsin just took away from public employees there and that they're getting rid of in Ohio, and they're threatening in Indiana and states all over the country. So the things that Dr. King fought for throughout his life, but especially at the end when he died in a strike for the right to union collective bargaining, couldn't be more relevant to right now.
Let's talk about what happened in Memphis, where he was when he was assassinated. The situation in Memphis was similar to what we're seeing. The situation in Memphis is similar to what we're seeing today in places like Wisconsin. You had a very antagonistic mayor and city government against workers. Can you paint for our listeners the story of what brought Dr. King to Memphis in the first place?
Well, he was actually in the middle of organizing his Poor People's Campaign, and that was a larger, broader agenda in a sense. He was trying to organize poor people to go to Washington, put pressure on Congress to reorder the nation's priorities, saying that we should stop spending our money on war, tax breaks for the rich. We should put that money into housing, healthcare, education, and jobs, and particularly for poor people who had been left out of the economy, and of course, they're disproportionately African-American, Latino, and Native American, and other minority groups. And then the strike was going on simultaneously in Memphis, which started on February 12th. And they kept asking him, please come to Memphis. We need your help. And this is the kind of thing that happened with King all the time. People asked him to come and support their movement. So finally, on March 18th, which is from that speech that you just played, he did come to Memphis. And it was a remarkable speech because he was able to fly in from, he was coming from L.A. and Mississippi and finally to Memphis, and he landed in the middle of a mass meeting of about 15,000 people, the biggest mass meeting of the civil rights era in the South. Most places didn't have enough room to put that many people, but this was at the Church of God in Christ in Memphis, which was had a big auditorium. And he gave a remarkable speech, and at the end of it, he called for a general strike. And he said if all the teachers and the students, talking primarily about the black community, and the workers, 80% of the unskilled labor was done by black workers, domestic workers, if everybody went on strike, this city would shut down. And that part of the speech, he gets this tremendous roar of approval from the audience, and it's because they all know that this is true, that African Americans actually do most of the hard work, and they could shut the place down. And then his last speech, the mountaintop, the night before he's killed on April 3rd, when he gives that speech, he's really sort of culminating his whole struggle for human rights with a labor perspective and calling for economic justice.
So the message that he had about labor and dignity of labor, was that a sort of an almost natural progression from the civil rights work that he was doing to then be struggling for economic rights?
Exactly. In fact, he explained it this way. He said that the Black Freedom Movement for civil rights, voting rights, equal accommodations, due process in the courts, he said these are all things that were ours to begin with, or should have been. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments after the Civil War granted these rights. We became citizens. We should have all the same rights that everybody else has, but those rights were then taken away. So the part that most people think of King's life is what King calls Phase One, which is the civil rights struggle from the Montgomery bus boycott through Birmingham, Selma, Albany, various campaigns in the South, which ended up producing the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. But at the end of that, there were all these urban uprisings going on in Watts L.A. and other places all over the country. And King said, you know, getting civil rights is not enough because you may have the right to go to a lunch counter, but you don't have any money to buy anything. And so he said, we really have to have phase two, which is the struggle for what he called economic equality. And he always had that on his agenda. It wasn't really something new. He always thought in terms of kind of stages. And, you know, until people had voting rights and civil rights, they wouldn't have any power to affect any change. But he said, but that wasn't freedom. That was just trying to establish rights that should have been ours to begin with. Freedom is true equality, and true equality means economic as well as civil rights.
Now, what we're seeing happening today in places like Wisconsin and even Ohio and other parts of the country where the attacks on unions have generated a tremendous backlash from people, especially in Wisconsin, we saw tremendous amounts of organizing. What were the tactics and unions and workers are using today, whether consciously or unconsciously, that were developed under Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement?
It's kind of interesting. The mass demonstrations, sit-ins, sit-downs, picketing, petitioning, all forms of nonviolent protest that people are using today are, of course, the same ones that people used in the civil rights movement. But King used to like to point out, and he does in these labor speeches, that these tactics were actually pioneered in the industrial union movement of the 1930s. And, of course, you could take it further back than that. The labor movement has always used these nonviolent tactics, but particularly in the 1930s, we had the sit-down strikes and a lot of mass demonstrations and a lot of picket lines. And so he was harking back to those methods that the labor movement used. Now we're harking back to the methods that the civil rights movement used, but actually it's kind of a continuum, which is the nonviolent means of protest. They're tried and true, and you know that's what people have always done. It's American tradition. And when the electoral process doesn't work and the political process doesn't work and the courts don't work, they're all on the side of the rich at the moment. You have to have direct action.
Michael Honey, having studied the situation at the time when King was in this phase of organizing the Poor People's Campaign, economic equality, etc., how do you compare economic conditions during that time and what we're seeing today? Are they similar? Are we worse off today than back then?
Well, in one respect, things are worse. In the time when King was doing what he was doing, the problem was that a lot of African Americans had been left out of the economic expansion of the 1960s and the post-war period. And part of it was because cotton had been mechanized and a lot of the agricultural labor that people had been doing was now done by machines. And so they became just a surplus population in places like Mississippi, which was the first stop on the Poor People's Campaign. People were living in absolute misery and without enough food to eat, conditions like you might expect in a very poor country somewhere overseas. And so he was focusing on that. But the other problem, and it comes out very clearly in these speeches, was deindustrialization. At that time when he was organizing, about 35% of American workers belonged to unions. Well, now it's around 9%. Public employee unions, about 30-some percent. But in the private sector, it's way down to like 7% are in unions. So the strength that the labor movement had in industrial enterprises is almost gone, and it's because of offshoring and shipping our jobs overseas and mechanizing the jobs and destroying unions in various industries. So we're in a weaker position, really, than we were then. And, of course, the people that pay the highest price for this are African-American, Latino, and other workers of color, and women particularly. Good-paying jobs in Memphis when King was there were industrial jobs that had been unionized. Union wages were middle-class wages. Well, those jobs are almost entirely gone in Memphis now. So, you know, on one level, our freedoms have expanded. Phase one has done pretty well in the sense of being able to elect Barack Obama as president. That's evidence that we've made a lot of progress in phase one for civil rights and voting rights. But phase two, economic justice, I'd say we're further behind than ever. We really haven't made much advance on phase two.
I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Honey, the Fred T. and Dorothy G. Haley Endowed Professor of the Humanities and a Professor of Labor and Ethnic Studies and American History at the University of Washington in Tacoma. He's the award-winning author of Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, and Martin Luther King's Last Campaign, as well as his latest book, All Labor Has Dignity. This is Uprising, and later in the hour, we'll take a look at how immigrant labor is organizing in the context of the national labor struggles. And after this week's edition of The Right Hook, we'll speak with a Wisconsinite filmmaker who returns to her home state to document the labor resurgence there. Stay tuned.
Welcome to The Right Hook, a weekly segment which covers the machinations of the right wing, from the Republican Party to the Tea Party Patriots and beyond. I'm Chris Bennett. Labor unions in America are under attack by the right wing in ways large and small, ideological and illogical. It's an Orwellian assault designed to snuff out the rights of people to collective bargaining, and even to erase symbols of labor. In Maine, Republican Governor Paul LePage has started a skirmish with the state's unions by ordering a mural of Maine's labor history to be removed from the state's Department of Labor. The mural in question depicts scenes from Maine's labor history. Paul LePage's idea of labor history is to forget it ever happened. Or, as George Orwell might say, quote, "The most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history." Perhaps Governor LePage sees this as a twofer. Kill some art, kill some labor union art history. But the right wing is a big tent, so I've heard, and while we spend a lot of time calling out right-wing Pauls for being enablers of a runaway war machine, the war makers themselves don't always hate art. This fall, for instance, Department of Defense workers moving into a brand new building may get to walk by an inspiring new sculpture in the lobby. One of four finalists for the space, the new sculpture depicts a 10-foot-tall fairy riding atop a giant toad. Sometimes a fairy riding a toad is just a fairy riding a toad. But this one costs about $500,000. That's cheap. Only about a third the cost of a Tomahawk cruise missile. And it is almost a perfect representation of America's foreign policy. The imaginary fairy of democracy riding atop a swamp-dwelling amphibian in search of oil, no doubt. But while the democracy fairies spread their love around the globe, there's a war on back home. And the labor movement, after playing rope-a-dope the last generation or so, has found a flicker of fight, most recently in Wisconsin. Earlier this year, crowds of 100,000 union members and supporters protested for weeks against Governor Scott Walker's plan to eliminate collective bargaining rights. According to Reuters, Wisconsin citizens have collected enough signatures to force a recall election for Republican State Senator Dan Capanke. Walker's legislative shenanigans have roused workers to target, no select, 17 more Republicans for recall elections. If Capanke goes down, Wisconsin union supporters will need to win just two more recall elections to give control of the Senate to Democrats. Walker himself is up for recall in 2012. Last Friday, Judge Mary Ann Sumi delayed for at least 2 months the implementation of Walker's anti-union bill. And yesterday in Wisconsin was another election on the state Supreme Court. If challenger Joanne Kloppenburg defeats conservative Justice David Prosser, Democrats will reverse and hold a 4-3 majority on the court. The gears of democracy are getting the rust knocked off of them this week. So remember, don't let anyone tell you to sit down and shut up. Now, where have we heard that before? For Uprising, I'm Chris Bennett, and this is The Right Hook, reality-based news and views.
Thanks, Chris. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Yesterday was Election Day in Wisconsin, and by all accounts, the ballot became a barometer of the electorate's support for Governor Scott Walker's agenda. The most hotly contested race with long-term implications may be for the state's Supreme Court seat. The two nominees are considered to reside at opposite ends of the ideological spectrum. Incumbent Supreme Court Judge David Prosser is a self-described judicial conservative and is favored by the right. Joanne Kloppenburg, an assistant state attorney, is backed by progressives. Governor Scott Walker's controversial legislation that curbed collective bargaining rights for public employees is currently tied up in the courts. Legal challenges are expected to take it all the way to the state Supreme Court, where the winner of Tuesday's elections will rule on it. This has catapulted the race between Prosser and Kloppenburg into the national spotlight. The usually low-key contest for a spot on the court is now a highly charged fight within the battle between Scott Walker and Labour. Money is pouring in from all sides. The Washington Post reports that independent expenditures on the race may surpass $5 million. The 26 historic days when Wisconsinites occupied the state capitol in Madison earlier this year led up to this electoral moment. Los Angeles-based filmmaker Amy Williams is originally from Wisconsin. When she heard what was transpiring in her home state, she rushed back to document the historic movement as it unfolded. Amy Williams now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising, Amy Williams.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So we've talked to you on our program before while you've been in Wisconsin. You're back now in Los Angeles where you're based, but you're originally from Wisconsin. And now that, you know, there's been so much historic, such movement building that's so historic happening in Wisconsin, have you been able to step back and view it all from a broader perspective? And if so, what have these post-Wisconsin days been like for you, if you will?
It's strange because it was such a heady time, you know, those 26 days of occupying the Capitol and being in the throes of it. And now back in California where I live, I've been having these strange dreams and flashbacks and really feeling like I'm reconnecting with my Wisconsin roots. I left the state 20 years ago and traveled the world, basically. And to come back and find that as a filmmaker, the issues that I've been the most engaged with in my career are playing out right in my own proverbial childhood backyard was quite remarkable. And I felt like I was kind of, you know, in the right place at the right time. And I have all this personal, I was explaining to a friend of mine, you know, what it's like to be from Wisconsin is people always usually say that people from the Midwest are really decent people, you know, that we can kind of tolerate difference and we can debate issues and accept difference. And we're just decent, kind human beings, right? And the Wisconsin demonstrations were just that. They were peaceful. They were funny. They were a cross-section of all kinds of different people with different views coming together. But what they united them was this rage against Walker and his anti-union legislation. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that Wisconsin for me was a wake-up call, not just for me as a filmmaker, but for the rest of the country. And stepping back and looking at, okay, now where do we go? Where do we go with the marching? Where do we go with the chanting? And the struggle for my friends who are still there and for those of us who care about this spark that was ignited in Wisconsin is to ask, what are we uniting around? What are we struggling for? And where do we go from here?
Right. Well, currently, politically in Wisconsin, there are efforts to, of course, challenge the collective bargaining part of the law that was passed that would decimate collective bargaining, to challenge that in court. There's an election on Tuesday that would take, we'd find out what the makeups of the court would be that would decide this. And also there are recall efforts, I understand, happening again against 16 state senators, 8 Republicans, 8 Democrats. Are those, you know, tell us a little bit about those post-movement efforts that are going through some of these channels. Where are they coming from?
Well, there was a lot of energy that was generated during those 26 days. And so they've taken basically the nucleus of the struggle that used to be just this constant circle around the Capitol, and they've expanded it to the entire state. And there's been phone bankings, there's been teach-ins, there have been door-to-door canvassing to get out the recall effort. And they did collect enough signatures for Dan Capanke. So he's the first person that they filed for recall. It's the 8th recall movement in the history of the state of Wisconsin.
Wow.
So this hasn't been something that's been done. I did speak with Rachel, who's sort of my ear to the ground there, the social worker that was on your show. And she said, you know, it's been really difficult to know how that recalled effort is going. As you said, there's 8 on both sides. And she said, even in a place like Milwaukee, which is where I grew up, which is known as more Democratic, that the feeling was in the phone banking rooms that they couldn't really say whether or not they were going to be successful with the recall efforts. So that's really disturbing.
And why the recall efforts against Democrats?
Well, I think that there's definitely a feeling from the Republicans that having left the state, 14 left the state, right? They basically skirted their duties as legislators and that they should be recalled because that's
so those recall efforts are coming from the Republicans against
yes.
the Democrats,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Okay. So now I want to turn to some of those voices on the ground, some of those voices that you captured whose audio we can hear a little bit. But of course, you're a filmmaker. Your YouTube channel for our listeners is youtube.com/whywisconsin. But I want to play for our listeners an excerpt, a small clip of one of the videos that you did.
I worked down in Milwaukee as a probation and parole agent. I've been down here 6 days now, 7 days now, off and on. Whenever I don't have to work or can get a vacation day, I'm here.
This is the 10th day we've been here. The first day I started with the students group and we brought Valentine's down to the governor's office, and I was so excited about that because it was so big. And then the next day we came, I was surprised more because there was 13,000 people, and then the next day 30,000. So we've been here every day.
Normal course of business in the legislature, when we're talking about funding levels for different programs and stuff, you know, we take our lumps, and sometimes we get laid off, and sometimes the programs get added to, sometimes they get subtracted from, but nobody ever has tried to take our rights away.
Well, it's a threat in that collective bargaining for all of labor, whether it's the public sector or private sector, brings an equality to the workplace.
This is about working people having dignity in the workplace and a right to have a say in the workplace.
Tell me what democracy looks like!
This is what democracy looks like!
Where are you from?
Madison.
Oh, cool. What do you do?
I'm a kindergarten teacher.
All right.
City housing.
All right. Right on. I'm a social worker. Right.
Good, good.
I'll tell you. I'm standing in the House of Labor. I love this organization. It was built on sweat, blood, and tears, and the foundation is solid!
Actually, I came from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, so up here in solidarity with all my brothers and sisters in support of workers' rights and support of all of these social programs that are being cut here in the state of Wisconsin.
And that is an excerpt of some of the video that you took while you were in Wisconsin, those 26 historic days at the state capitol. And you were talking to, so many people. The video shows the sea of people that were there. So many voices that you could potentially capture. Tell us a little bit about how important it was for you to capture a broad cross-section of voices, because, of course, there were workers of all stripes there. There were also students there who weren't even union workers, but who were there in solidarity with them. And they were just ordinary Wisconsinites who weren't necessarily involved in the public employees unions, but who were, who were just shocked by what they were seeing.
I mean, as the movement grew, so did the demographic. I literally saw that. So in the beginning, as you heard in the video, it was mainly students. They were driven by the Teachers Association, which is a labor union that represents graduate students, the TAA. But there were also a lot of undergrad students that were coming, and it was kind of fun to sleep over and bring your sleeping bag. And it was it was organized by the students. But then the public employee unions, which are the first ones to have their rights, decimated by this bill, basically AFSCME started to come. And then I think the day that things started to really turn was when the cops marched in. Mm-hmm. And I have a wonderful young police officer, Madison police officer, who had it, Actually, also, I want to also talk about these new the election today. There's two measures that are being put on the ballot that the firefighters are bringing forth, a measure that are saying that they've been discriminated against because they were exempted from this bill. So there was this solidarity that was growing. So I think, like I said, when the cops marched in, they were taking a tray of bratwurst to the students because they hadn't eaten all day. And the place just erupted and it became, okay, we're one of you. We're not going to be on the other side. And that was published widely in the newspapers. And I think once the cops stepped up, suddenly now a lot of people started coming out. And you would go out every day around 4 to 6, which is when people got off of work. And you'd just see this steady stream of all kinds of folks circling the Capitol, going in, you know, writing signs. Lots of families, lots of kids in strollers. You'd overhear conversations of mothers saying, now this is democracy and this is what's wrong. And the child would ask questions. And,
wow, what a learning moment.
Yeah, amazing.
Better than
amazing.
Being in school. So, Amy, with the with what you witnessed in Wisconsin, what was the sort of gender dynamic that you noticed? Because, of course, a lot of, you know, most of the unions that were exempted from the law, the security unions, the law enforcement, firefighters, those are primarily male-dominated unions. Did that cause people to sort of question the gender dynamics of who was being attacked and who was not?
You know, I just want to tell you a quick story. I love that you asked me this question because I think the issue of gender has really been overlooked in this entire Wisconsin story, and that an attack on, you know, collective bargaining rights has really been an attack on women, nurses, teachers, social workers, secretaries, and the growth of the labor movement in the last 10 years. We really have immigrant women to thank for that. But I'll tell you, one day I hadn't had a good conversation with a teacher, and I went outside and I thought, I just want to find a teacher. And I saw this woman sitting in front of a statue. There's a beautiful bronze statue, which you've probably seen in some of the footage, which is a woman, and her hand is raised to the sky, and the name of the statue is Miss Forward, and it was built during the suffragist movement in Wisconsin. Wisconsin has a great historical legacy of getting women to vote. And there's a smaller version of Miss Forward on the very top of the Capitol, a gold version of her. And a lot of people look to her, a lot of women in Wisconsin look to her for strength and support. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful statue. So this teacher looked quite downturned. She was sort of sitting and kind of looking down. And I said, it was very cold. And I said, are you a teacher by any chance? And she said, I am. I teach at Madison Memorial High School. And I said, what's wrong? And she said, you know, I come here every day and I sit at the foot of this statue just to gain strength so that I can go back and teach my kids and I can, you know, sucker hope from her. And then she told me the story of who Miss Forward was. And I said, well, why are you feeling so downturned? And she said, you know, people keep coming and putting blindfolds over her and pasting her with signs. And I'm tired of seeing her looking like she's ravaged by this movement. I'm going to put her with garlands of flowers. And she started putting flowers all around her. It was just one of those moments, one of those feminine moments that I thought was really revealing.
And so do you think that there has been enough consciousness raised among those who marched? You know, were women's voices heard during the rallies? You know, were people seeing the attacks as being attacks on women?
I don't think people have articulated it as such, because I think the main voice that's coming out of Wisconsin is we are all Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. We are all one, and that we're all united against Walker and the Republicans. However, International Women's Day occurred while I was there, and there was a women's march, and there was some discussion. And there's definitely – okay, this is completely unscientific, but I would say 3/4 of the protesters and the people who slept in the Capitol were women.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. So they were on the front lines. They took the risks, and they, you know, there's a picture. There's a piece of one of your videos of a young woman being dragged out with a sign in her hand. And, you know, it almost brings tears to your eyes to see her. And then you juxtapose that with some of the young African-American men who were dragged out 40 something years earlier. So it was pretty remarkable. This week also commemorates the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., which happened April 4th, 1968. And there have been demonstrations happening, rallies happening around the country, We Are One rallies. And you did a video as a filmmaker that brought up in a visual format the similarities between the tactics that civil rights activists used in the 60s that Martin Luther King Jr. brought up up, particularly with respect to labor rights. We just had an interview with Michael Honey, who brought up that the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. in Wisconsin. But you were able to bring together these images of people demonstrating in the 60s and people demonstrating just a few months ago in Wisconsin. The similarities are striking. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think a lot of people don't actually realize that at the end of his life, Martin Luther King was definitely moving in a new direction in terms of linking the civil rights movement to the labor movement. And he was in Memphis, and he was marching with the sanitation workers, which were AFSCME members, the same mm-hmm. union,
right.
And predominantly black male. And they had a march called the I Am a Man March, that my dignity and my rights, both as a black male and as a worker, as a public employee, are what they're linked. And he, if you listen to his later speeches, the speech prior to the Memphis March and leading up to that march, I just want to read something. In the video I did, I quoted why we need to support labor unions and how they're completely linked to the economy and to dignity, and wage and income defines who you are as a person and defines society as a whole, right? So this is from one of his later speeches. "These are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. And out of the wounds of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are born. The people who sat in darkness have now seen a great light."
And we link to that video from our website, uprisingradio.org, so that people can see those words up on the screen interspersed with the footage from that time. And it is pretty remarkable. How do you feel that the movement in Wisconsin, the people who showed up in Wisconsin, were thinking consciously about what MLK had taught America? Or has it sort of become part of our national subconscious, if you will?
Well, you know, I think... that's why I titled my film, Why Wisconsin? I'm still struggling with that question myself. Why did this happen in Wisconsin? Of course, similar things are happening in Ohio and Indiana and Florida because similar legislation has been either passed or introduced. And I don't know. You know, I really don't have the answer as to why this happened in Wisconsin, except that I have to say that there is a proud history of labor rights. And we talked about this before, that it's mm-hmm. where the eight-hour workday comes from, unemployment benefits. We have in Wisconsin also a commitment to open meetings, to discussion. And that was completely shut down by the legislature and by Governor Walker and how they passed this bill. And the palpable anger that I could feel from those people that showed up. I mean, they had just had enough. You know, you can only take so much if someone's beating you up. And it's just that one blow that makes you turn around and stand up and fight. Mm. And I think as the movement grew and as there were so many different cross-sections of people, there was a feeling that you could get rejuvenated and regenerated by talking to a nurse meeting a cop and talking, or, you know, a social worker sitting down with a young child, or, you know, even a filmmaker having an interview with a 67-year-old retired employee whose husband's a farmer and they're losing their farm. And so as these conversations were building and as the movement was building, I think Wisconsin was – I think we're on the cusp of asking the question of where we're going in this country and what is democracy? What are my rights as an individual? What are my rights as a worker? And, you know, what are my rights as a parent? And are these things that I need to fight for? You know, do we all have to fight for these daily? And I guess the answer is yes.
There were a lot of signs in the videos that you took in Wisconsin that people had the word democracy on them, you know, that you can't kill democracy, or this is what democracy looks like, which is the common refrain that we just even heard. And it's, I think, quite impressive that people are able to link and were linking very openly the concept of workers' rights, the desire to need, you know, to want to speak and be part of the public discourse to the very notion of democracy, which, you know, Republicans claim that they're for, and as do all elected officials. So that's, I think, was a pretty powerful you know, powerful aspect of it. And I'm wondering if that'll have some impact also on electoral politics. As we've been talking about elections in Wisconsin, I'm sure the turnout is going to be higher than average for an election that's, you know, not a presidential election.
Yeah, a lot of money has been spent on both sides. I mean, so Kloppenberg is running against him, and apparently they've spent about the same amount of money, and they're doing mudslinging ads, and it's interesting. Obviously, Prosser is somebody that's publicly come out and said that he totally supports what Walker is doing, and a lot of the get out the vote efforts have been to try to unseat him, and who knows what's going to happen. This will be a kind of a clarion call today. Mm-hmm. We'll figure out what's going to happen with the rest of the recall efforts. But again, the measures I spoke about, and I think this is at the core of how we see our exercise in democracy and how it's going to play out from Wisconsin nationwide. So two measures have been put forth from an organization. I don't know if you know this organization, Wisconsin Wave. And one is for the city of Madison and one is for the entire United States. And it's basically trying to reverse Citizens United law.
Which is a Supreme Court law that allows corporations to have unlimited spending on campaigns.
So. And some of the language in this measure is really interesting. That they're saying that corporations are not people, so they should not be entitled to constitutional protection and rights, and that money is not speech. It's not free speech. And so it's sort of interesting that both these measures are being put forth in Wisconsin, and I do think that that's at the core of all of this,
really, is
how much money is being spent on these elections. Who votes? Why do they vote? And it's one thing to put your feet to pavement and march and pick up a phone and do phone banking, but it's another thing to question the way in which our entire electoral system is run. And how do you do that, really? I mean, you can't do that with a mass movement. You have to take these things to the ballot.
Mm-hmm. And those things could set a precedent nationwide, because those are very important questions, the whole concept of corporate personhood and money in elections.
Well, and labor unions as well. I mean, they spend a ton of money on elections as well. So, I mean, if we rethink the way money is being spent on elections and we figure out how people are getting elected, I think you're going to look at a completely different country.
Well, we'll see. Has Wisconsin changed the U.S. forever or not? Only time will tell. Amy Williams, I want to wish you the best of luck with your film, and I'm sure we'll have you back on when the film is complete. Thanks so much.
Thanks again. Bye.
And again, Amy Williams' website is youtube.com/ywisconsin. I've been speaking with Amy Williams, a filmmaker who documented the 26 historic days in Madison, Wisconsin. This is Uprising. Our website is uprisingradio.org, where you can watch the video of my interview with Amy Williams, as well as links to her own videos. After this short break, we'll take a look at how immigrant labor fits into today's labor organizing. Stay tuned.
When did you come to America? Your crops, came to build your roads, your cities and your thoughts. Say you don't need me, but you know what you've got. This land is your land and my land and your land, from California to the New York Islands. This land is my
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. While the labor movement's resurgence in Wisconsin has received much-deserved public and media attention, many hard-fought labor struggles often get overlooked, particularly those of immigrant labor. It is estimated that about 15% of the American workforce is made up of undocumented immigrants. Industries where immigrants dominate are farm work, service work, domestic work, and construction. In recent years, with the uptick in immigration detention and deportation, begun in earnest under President Bush and escalated under President Obama, immigrant labor is scapegoated on multiple fronts. Traditionally, labor unions have seen immigrants as part of the problem of low wages, despite the pressures pushing in particular Latin American workers into the U.S. through free trade agreements like NAFTA. But immigrants have been organizing on their own through union-like organizations, alliances, and networks, fighting for better working conditions and better wages. One such organization is the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, and my guest is its executive director, Pablo Alvarado. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you for having me.
So first, how have you been viewing these labor struggles as somebody who's involved for a long time in organizing, but specifically around immigrant labor? How have you viewed what has been unfolding this year in the Midwest in states like Wisconsin and Ohio and other parts of the country?
Well, you know, I think it's part of a well-thought-out attack against unions and against working people. I think what Wisconsin is teaching is that, you know, the same people that oppose migrant workers are the same people that are against unions, you know. So I think there's an opportunity here to bring unions and migrant workers together. I think, like, you know, because of unions are declining, there's kind of like a parallel labor movement across the country, and you would see in many cities worker centers, worker institutions that protect labor rights, you know, and these are not unions, and it's a lot of them. So it's a parallel labor movement, I would say.
So kind of like the National Day Labor Organizing Network?
Kind of like NDLON, the National Domestic Workers Alliance, the National Guest Workers Alliance. So these are groups that national organizations that are member-based. In the country, for example, there are 65 day labor centers. These are places where people gather to look for work and where workers set their own minimum wage. Workers learn how to negotiate, where workers come together to, you know, demand unpaid wages from, you know, abusive employers. So these are institutions that, you know, essentially do what unions do, and because they are declining, you know, these new institutions are emerging.
Well, so what is the difference specifically then? Why not have a formal union instead of an organizing network or some of these alliances?
I think it's going in that direction. There are, of course, you know, differences. And for instance, in the day labor industry, collective bargaining is not a possibility because workers don't have just one employer. They have thousands of employers. So it's kind of difficult to, you know, get into negotiating a contract with an employer under those circumstances. And similarly with the domestic workers, you know, where women are isolated working for one family, you know. So, I mean, so these are characteristics of this type of market, and there is a significant number of workers that are excluded from labor law, and we have to be creative as to how we protect their rights, their workers' rights.
So in a way, organizations like yours are filling in the gap for many workers, particularly immigrant workers, for whom it is more difficult perhaps to organize under the umbrella of a formal union, but they still have the legal right to unionize, don't they?
Well, everybody has any worker has the legal right to unionize. Workers, where they are documented or undocumented, have rights, and unionization is one of those rights that, you know, haven't been taken away by the people that are attacking unions in Wisconsin. Of course, they would like to see that. They would like to see that migrant workers are excluded completely from every single labor law, but it's not illegal for undocumented workers to organize.
So, in the movements that we're seeing today, this almost resurgence of the popularity of unions, at least public employee unions, the fact that there's more public attention, there's broad support across the United States for the union struggles. Do you feel that immigrant labor, which is such a huge and undeniable part of American labor today, has it been left behind, if you will, in the struggles that in the very high profile struggles that we're seeing this year?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, the fact that we haven't been able to get immigration reform with path to citizenship demonstrates that, you know, that progressive forces, including unions, haven't invested what needs to be invested in order to win. But I do think, like, that Wisconsin struggle will change things around, because I think for the first time they know that this is not about migrant workers, that there is a, you know, a right-wing agenda to go after unions because they support progressive causes, because they fund progressive politicians sometimes. You know, so now I think they understand that they are, as migrant workers are, under siege. Of course, there have been efforts by, you know, labor federations to organize and to have partnerships with worker center institutions. In 2006, we signed an agreement with the AFL-CIO, you know, in which we committed to invest resources to protect workers' rights and to push for immigration reform. I think that they're trying, but right now, you know, the economy is changing, and it depends more and more on contingent workers as employers, you know, try to find ways to either misclassify workers or to not be responsible for them, doing it through temp agencies, because that way they don't have to worry for payroll taxes or benefits, etc. They just hire workers that are disposable. They use them and they disregard them as objects. You know, that's where employers are standing. That the labor market has changed in that direction. So unions will have to find a way to change as well.
In some senses, this conflict between organized labor in the U.S. and immigrant labor is an old one. I'm looking at a critique that labor reporter David Bacon has written about Tom Hartman's new book, which is called Rebooting the American Dream. And in that book, Tom Hartman, of course, takes a very progressive line on American labor, but then does a different take, a not very progressive take, on immigration. He basically calls for protecting the labor market by driving immigrant workers out of it by using employer sanctions and immigration raids. This is the kind of thing that the AFL-CIO supported in 1986 when they backed the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which has now essentially been used to deport, fire and deport thousands of immigrants. But at the same time, this conflict is something that one has seen in the American past, in American history. We just passed the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. And in that case, there were, you know, underage immigrant girls from Eastern Europe that were primarily at the forefront of those movements. So in a way, are you seeing history repeat itself?
Of course. Of course. I mean, we've had times in which immigrants have been targeted, and times when labor has opened up, you know, the possibilities and include them. The Justice for Janitors campaign is one example. You know, there's an effort here in L.A. to organize the workers, the car washes throughout the city. You know, so and these are efforts that are being supported by unions. I mean, not all unions have you know, this kind of sentiment against migrant labor. But what's happening right now, you know, what happens in unions, I think it's a reflection of what's happening at the larger society. Right now, immigrants are under siege. And there's a significant number of union members who feel that migrant labor is undermining their wages and working conditions. And of course, you know, we argue that that's not the case, and that if you want to protect union wages and working conditions, then you have to organize the most vulnerable. You cannot send them farther to the shadows, because if you do that, then you automatically lower the standards for everybody else. You know, I think unions are starting to understand that. And at the end of the day, you know, I will say that immigrants are union members in waiting. Where, you know, when migrant workers obtain their documents, believe me, it's going to be a lot easier to bring them into unions. And I think, like, both worker centers and immigrant rights organizations really are very clear about that. you know, the importance of unions.
I'm speaking with Pablo Alvarado. He is the executive director of ENLON, the National Day Labor Organizing Network. Now, we recently passed the birthday of Cesar Chavez, and you know, there's a little bit of confusion over whether Cesar Chavez, in his organizing work, did support undocumented workers or not. What is your take on the legacy of Cesar Chavez with respect to immigration and the labor movement?
Well, I think that, you know, the thinking of organizers evolves with time. And I think, like, I'm not sure whether that happened or not, because I've heard stories that he even called ICE on, I mean, at that time, INS, on workers, you know. But people evolve. And I know that in the latest years of Cesar Chavez, he supported migrant labor. He understood that they're going after them wasn't the right thing to do. So I think, organizers, the thinking of organizers evolve with time and with new realities. That's a problem with some unions, that they're still operating like if they were in the 50s, in the 70s, like if the labor market remains the same. You know, that's exactly why, you know, union density is in decline. I mean, in the country, only about 9% of the workforce is unionized. And that is shrinking. That is not good for anybody. It's not good for unions. It's not good for society at large. You know, if it was up to the employers, workers would still be laboring 16 hours a day. Children would still be at the workplace. But, you know, we have to support labor. And I'm Cesar Chavez had the same intention, you know.
Well, finally, Pablo Alvarado, what would you like to see happen over the next few months and years with this revival, it seems, in organized labor? In a way, the Republicans have almost done labor a favor by making their attack so broad that it has enraged so many Americans and sparked so many battles across so many states. Would you basically like to see a coming together of immigrant labor organizations like yours with organized labor and a joint support for real immigration reform, as well as wages, good wages, and union rights for all?
Well, I would say that it began to happen already. In Wisconsin, there is an organization called Voces de la Frontera, and they mobilize about 20 buses of migrant workers to come and support the struggle that the union members were having in front of the Capitol in Wisconsin. That's exactly what is happening already. But I think, like, hope the unions take this advantage of this moment and change the perceptions that Americans have about unions, because the right wing has been very clever in, you know, demonizing unions, that they protect certain interests, et cetera, et cetera, that they are corrupt. These are all the things that they have been saying. And, of course, you know, they have gotten a free pass. But right now, I think people are beginning to understand that if you don't have unions, you know, you're not going to have, you know, a middle class in this country. And I think for the first time, I hear some union leaders talking about the working class. You know, and that's language that has been lost for some, you know, a long time ago. And now it's back. And I think, like, I hope that they seize this moment. You know, of course, I'm going to try that worker centers and my organization, you know, rise up to the challenge as well, so that we can begin, you know, bridging the gaps between migrant workers and native-born workers, you know.
Well, Pablo Alvarado, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website for your organization?
Sure. It's www.ndlon.org.
Thanks so much, Pablo.
A wonderful day.
I've been speaking with Pablo Alvarado. He is the executive director of the National Day Laborer Organizing Network. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I want to quote Martin Luther King Jr., who, in talking about the labor movement of the 30s, said this: "The labor movement was the principal force that transformed misery and despair into hope and progress. Out of its bold struggles, economic and social reform gave birth to unemployment insurance, old age pensions, government relief for the destitute, and above all, new new wage levels that meant not mere survival, but a tolerable life. The captains of industry did not lead this transformation. They resisted it until they were overcome. That's Martin Luther King Jr. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at pacificaradioarchives.org. You can listen to the show online, find links, local events, and other information that we mention on the air at uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.